The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hey folks, I challenge you to think of at least one thing you no longer do that you wish you could. Do you miss like playing golf, maybe long walks with your spouse, sleeping through the night? Are you ready to start living without pain? My colleagues and friends, Hugh Hewitt, Dennis Prager, Mike Gallagher, have been talking about their own successful experience with Relief Factor, and you can add Eric Metaxas to that list. Relief Factor is changing the lives of tens of thousands of Salem radio listeners by reducing and even eliminating daily aches and pains. ReliefFactor.com is full of great success stories, and now I am on board. For just $19.95, Relief Factor is offering a three-week quick start that could help you live your life with little to no pain. Go to ReliefFactor.com to see testimonials from folks all over the country. I love reading them. Over 70% of those that try Relief Factor continue as a customer. Feel the relief and get back your independence and freedom from the aches and pains of everyday life. Go to ReliefFactor.com. Read the testimonies. I tell all my relatives to take it. ReliefFactor.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. Please keep your arms and legs inside the car at all times.
This is your final warning.
Now, here's your host, Mr. Thrill Ride himself, Eric Metaxas.
Oh, hello. Hey, Alvin, we've got such an exciting show today.
We do.
That I'm almost literally bursting with excitement. Almost Lord. Literally bursting with excitement. First of all, I want to say that we've got Matt Walsh today. A lot of people know Matt Walsh. He's a madman. Buckle your seatbelts. We've got him coming up in the next segment for the rest of the hour. In hour two, we've got something we like to call Ask Metaxas. People get to ask me anything they like, and I answer quite brilliantly, if I may say so, and in some cases with a profundity that will blow you backwards in the room. It's an amazing thing. You don't want to miss it. But right now,
yes,
perhaps most exciting of all, people know that we are this month doing a fundraiser for Food for the Poor. We get very excited about this because we only work with folks that we think the world of. Food for the Poor is doing God's work around the world. Right now they're focused on Guatemala, which has the number one malnutrition in the Western Hemisphere. You think about that. In all of North and South America, they are singled out as suffering with such malnutrition that they need folks like us to help them. Food for the Poor helps them, but Food for the Poor needs our help. But right now, we get to talk to Paul Jacobs. We've had him on before. He's an advocate for Food for the Poor. He knows more about this than we do, so I'll shut up. Paul Jacobs, welcome.
It is great to be with you, Eric. Thank you. And this is more than a fundraiser. Your listeners have been overwhelmingly saving lives of families in Guatemala, the families that we've just met and come back from Guatemala a few weeks ago.
Well, I was going to say, I know you've been there, and I want to make this real for my audiences because sometimes they think, you know, it's just this abstract thing. They go to MetaxasTalk.com, they click on the banner. But you meet these people. You know that they're in these remote regions where they literally don't have safe drinking water, where the kids are suffering from malnutrition. Very hard for us in the West, who are so wealthy, frankly, to conceive that this is happening not far from our own shores.
No, absolutely. And, you know, here's an interesting thing. In our last trip to Guatemala, on our last community visit, we stepped at a community called La Culebra, which is about a 2.5-3 hour journey outside of Guatemala City. It's far from anything that would be considered modern civilization. It is a rural, arid community. It's literally in a dry corridor where drought since 2015 has wiped out large and small farms alike. These families live on these farms, live on the resources and work on these farms. And they've been out of work for so long because of this long-standing drought. And we come to a home in La Culebra, which means the viper, because it's such a snaky single-file, you know, single-lane road to get to this community. Very dangerous to get in and out of this community. And we come upon this mom, Palacita. And it's interesting because as we take this very dangerous walk up and around the bend to her home, I think to myself, as I'm a very, you know, able-bodied individual with very good shoes and you know, just one little bag on my back, how in the world is she making this trip hours at a time every single day to go find work or look for water for her family? And it just blows my mind. She has no shoes on. Her home is made of rotten wood and rusted metal. Her children sleep on a mud floor. And then what's striking is that the two smallest children, 5 and 3 years old, are literally standing there, very sullen faces, bloated bellies, as she tells us that they don't eat every day. And maybe what their diet consists of is a little bean, some tortilla, no protein, no real nutritional value at all. And I asked her, why are the children's bellies so bloated and so big? And she says, quite frankly, the water that we drink, it's polluted. It has holes in the pipes, and I can't get it clean enough. And so we're here asking listeners, like you listening right now, would you change the trajectory of a family like this with just one phone call, a gift, a donation, a life source, just a hand up, not a hand out, to provide food and clean, safe water for these families?
Well, I mean, I hate to say it, but when I think of the money that we waste in America, not just on ourselves, but in paying most of our taxes, where the money goes, to what bureaucracy, who's really getting helped. And then I think of something like this, where $80 can change a kid's life very dramatically, as you've described. $320 feeds a family of four and provides drinking water. I mean, the idea that these kids have parasites, these kids have malnutrition, nobody should have to go through that. When you have other countries like ours that, by comparison, are tremendously wealthy. I mean, $80 or $320 in America, it doesn't go so far. But in a country like this, it changes lives really dramatically. I want to give the phone number because I know there are people who prefer to call. By the way, I want to say people can go to MetaxasTalk.com. Please go to MetaxasTalk.com. You'll see the banner and it's all there. But if you prefer to call, it is 844-863-HOPE. That's 844-863-HOPE. I have to say, Paul, that, you know, as you make this so vivid to us, it's disturbing, but I hope it will move some people to do something about it, because nobody should have to live like this. I mean, I can't believe that. You said you were there just a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And,
you know, here's the thing. Everyone listening right now to the sound of our voice has probably gone through a rough patch. No one escapes tough times in life. And if you haven't, it's probably on the way. It's just inevitable. It's life. And, you know, I remember growing up with a single parent. There were months where we went without electricity, without running water in our home. This is under my roof in my childhood, my story. And I remember running home from the bus stop in the afternoons because I had to get home before the sun went down because there was no lights, and I had to do my homework before the sun went down and there was no lights in the house. You see, that is the story that I'm sure everyone here in America probably has experienced. But I tell you this, it is nothing like the families that with every sip have to pray over the water for their children to drink, and this mother who works 7 days a week, and she told us she earns maybe about $57 a month, less than $2 a day. It's not enough to do what she needs to save her family, provide food, provide clean water, and keep a roof over their head. So we can do with what God has provided us with the little that we have. And when I say little, I don't mean that flippantly. I mean that we can take our widow's mite and make a difference for families just like this. Or maybe God has blessed you. Maybe you can do something significant and give a large gift. Imagine $1,000, just $83 a month would provide three families, food for a year and water for life. Just think what you can do with what God has resourced you to do, to resource a pastor on the ground and save a family or several families.
And I was saying that, you know, food for the poor is tremendously reputable. I want to tee this up for people because people are looking for opportunities to give. They say, well, I want to tithe. I want to give money to do good things. But where do I go? What happens to the money? Am I giving it to a bureaucracy? In this case, you're not. And that's why we just want to tee it up for you, make it as easy as possible. There's a phone number. You can go to MetaxasTalk.com. The phone number, again, is 844-863-HOPE. 844-863-HOPE. And I know that if you can't give $320, you can give $27 a month. That's $320 over a year. And you can get your family involved. Teach your kids what your values are. And every month say, do we have our $27 to give to Food for the Poor? And have the kids put in a dollar or two from their allowance or from what they earn. And then the parents can put in the rest. And it's just a wonderful moment for a family to teach kids what we care about, that we do this because God has commanded us to help those who can't help themselves. It's a beautiful thing. I just want to give the number again. It's 844-863-HOPE, 844-863-HOPE. And, you know, Paul, as you said, there are folks listening who without a doubt can give $1,000 or $5,000 or $10,000. They won't miss it, and they're doing God's work. I hope that there are people listening right now at every level who will feel moved by what you've said. This is real. Again, we try to tee it up for you, make it as simple as possible, because people, they don't want to give to things that they're not sure about. We're sure about this. So, Paul Jacobs, thank you so much.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thank you, and thank all of your listeners for
being so generous. And I'm thanking them now, 844-863-HOPE. Thank you for calling, 844-863-HOPE, or go to our website, MetaxasTalk.com. Thank you very much. Hey there, folks. Welcome back. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. Today we have a special Ask Metaxas Hour for you, if we care. Chris and Albin, you're going to be asking me the questions. Maybe we should do a lightning round.
A lightning round. Usually they save that for the last part of the game show. But you want to start off with it.
You guys ask the questions, and I'll tell you which ones to skip if some of them look too complicated. Ready and go.
Okay, Barb says, I am wondering if you ever looked into Grand Duchess Elizabeth Fedorovna of Russia as a woman of faith. I have not found a lot written about her.
Okay, and to that I will say no.
No.
Second question.
Chris, you want to ask that?
No, you go, Albin. Take the next one.
Okay, Travis says, okay, following up on the Matt Walsh interview, remember we did him about, you did him a couple weeks ago. I'd love to hear who would classify as the Wilberforce-like Christian leader today that wouldn't shrink back from the public stage to provide thoughtful leadership. Who are those that we should be listening to and seeking out in the public life?
Okay, I'm going to say really quick off the top of my head, either me, Eric Metaxas, or Joe Biden. Next question.
Okay.
What are three things you are doing to keep yourself sane during the quarantine?
I'm working really hard. I'm writing. It's a wild thing to be in New York City, stuck in our apartment. So I'm working. I'm doing this program. I'm writing actually two books at once, and I've got some other things that I have to work on. All my speaking gigs have been canceled, so it's a big financial hit, so I better be writing hard. And in the evenings, I'm relaxing by watching historic dramas from the BBC on streaming video, or like I mentioned earlier, on Turner Classic Movies. Sometimes they have great movies on there. Last night, they had Some Like It Hot, which is one of the funniest movies. The writing of it is so brilliant, I was astounded at the writing. I don't even know who wrote it. It was directed, I think, by Billy Wilder, but it was absolutely, the writing was genius.
And nowadays, you couldn't even make a movie like that. It's too sexist, but funny. Yeah. Yes, unfortunately.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Eric, have you read The American Revolutionary Mind?
I've not read it, but we had the author on this program, and it was wonderful. You can look it up on our YouTube channel, Eric Metaxas Show. But we had him on. I didn't read the book, but it was quite good.
Okay, a quick correction on that. You actually interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, but we have not yet aired that particular episode. His name's C. Bradley.
My memory
Thompson.
Is correct that I That's did right. interview the author, but we've not yet aired it. Okay,
That's
there you
right.
go.
That's right. Chris, question. Chris, you got a question?
Yeah, Barb is asking, I'm wondering if you have ever looked, oh, sorry, wrong one, connection here. Have you ever met Eric Idle?
Eric Idle.
I-D-O-L?
I-D-L-E.
From Monty Python.
Yeah, Monty Python.
I've never met Eric Idle, but I have met Eric Idle. I have a friend, a very good friend, named Eric Idle, E-I-T-E-L, and I'm working on him with him on some projects. He's a dear friend. I've never met anyone from Monty Python. No, I have not. Now, by the way, I don't know where you're getting these questions from, because the questions that I have, number four was from Rita. So we're doing a lightning round, and I just want to make sure that we're going in the right order. Am I mixed up?
No, you're not. I will ask you number four right now. It's just that we're in our bunkers and the numbers are getting scrambled here. Rita says, what is the purpose of prophecy? I know what it is, but wonder why it is necessary to tell the future, and in quotes, often far future, and with cryptic statements. Purpose of prophecy.
Right. Well, while what? Now, that is a big one. We have to step outside of our lightning round to deal with that one. I think every thinking person has similar questions about prophecy in the modern era. Is it real? Is it phony? What is real? How do we know what's real? A lot of people would say that Christianity teaches that this is something from the past, that once the canon of scripture ended, after the first century, there's no longer a role for prophecy. A lot of other people like me would say, no, there is a role of the prophetic in the church today, just as there's a role for people praying and people getting healed miraculously and all that kind of stuff. But the question of prophecy is very interesting and very deep. And I think I should go into that the next time Ken Fish is on the program to get his answers on that, because I do think that prophecy can be abused. I have experienced that, which is why I get very angry when people who have this extraordinary gift are sloppy with it, because people are hanging on your every word. They say, God is speaking. If God is speaking, I need to listen. And we need to be really careful that we are broken, sinful vessels whom God chooses to use sometimes. And if he chooses to use us in a way that's prophetic, we need to be tremendously careful about it. And when we say prophecy, we also have to be really clear. We're talking prophecy from the God of the Bible, from Jesus, not from whoever, because you can get a lot of messages from dark spirits, demonic spirits masquerading as, the ghost of Uncle George or somebody. And we have to be really, really wary. Spiritism, necromancy is something that the scripture warns against very, very strongly. And we have to make sure that if we're hearing from something supernatural, that it is from God, whether it's an angel or through a prophet. And so this is something that requires real maturity, and you need to be very, very careful with it. That's all I'll say for now, but that's probably more than enough.
Okay, here's a question from Alvin in Terrytown. How many rolls of toilet paper do you have left?
The answer is, I don't know. Plenty, I'll wager.
Chris?
Yeah, number five. Rebecca asks, you've shown much courage in your views about the permanency of marriage. Thank you. However, at times you speak out of both sides of your mouth. Divorce, remarriage is wrong. And yet so many guests who are in remarriages and you talk as they are blessed of God, you celebrate the relationship. Would you have married a Christian homosexual on the show and celebrate that marriage? I couldn't read it very well.
Would I have on as a guest a married Christian homosexual and celebrate that marriage?
Well, yes, that's right. Sorry.
I don't consider when you're talking about marriage, you have to define your terms. Are you talking about marriage in God's eyes or in the world's eyes, right? So Donald Trump has been married three times. There are some Christians who would say that his second and third marriages are pure adultery, that he has never been married to those women. I would not take that view. It doesn't mean that I take divorce lightly. I think it's really it's an issue of perspective and context. It's a good question, Rebecca. Thank you for asking it, because I think that, first of all, let me say this. It is not my role as host of this program to call out all of my guests on moral issues. I have had people who self-identify as gay in gay relationships on the program. I obviously don't take that lightly. I take it very seriously. But typically, it's not the kind of thing that I would bring up unless it is the subject about which we're talking already. But I don't think if somebody comes on the program and I know them to in the past have had an adulterous relationship or to be in a third marriage, to bring that up, not because I don't have views on such things, but I just think that as the host of this program, I have to wonder what my viewers are interested in. I have to also understand that, well, I should communicate now, and this is a good reason to have Ask Metaxas segments, to say that when I have someone on the program, it certainly does not mean that I approve of everything that they've done or that they stand for or their views theologically. But that should go without saying. We're always supposed to talk to people with whom we disagree. And it doesn't mean we always have to talk about the things about which we disagree. So it's a tricky thing. I've had a lot of people on this program whose views theologically and whose views politically I differ with very strongly. And I know that I've had people on the program and will have people on the program with whom I have differing views with regard to sexuality and marriage. So I don't think having somebody on the program who has been remarried, I don't think that is the occasion for a time for me to bring up whether their marriage is in fact adultery. I personally don't think in many cases that it is. I think that there's a place for grace, but I do feel very strongly about divorce, as you know. So this is complicated. I hope you don't feel I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth in answering this. I just want to say that it is complicated.
Yeah, Eric, this you know what? This is not a gotcha program. They don't come on here and then you corner them somewhere. And
That's a big part of it. By the way, speaking of which, we're going to have to go to a break. So I can't, but it's not a gotcha program. I don't bring people on to lure them onto the program and suddenly say, hey, you're a hypocrite. But you know what? I really love that question, Rebecca. Awesome question. We'll be right back with more Ask Metaxas.
Make like a Mr. Milquetoast, you'll get shut out.
Hey, folks, welcome back. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. We're doing a special hour. We call it Ask Metaxas. Today, I'm playing the role of Metaxas, and you all get to ask me all the questions you like. Ask Metaxas starts now. Go.
Go. Cody from Colorado asks, how old are you? What's your favorite food? And do you golf?
Wow. Don't know. I don't know that I have a favorite food. I love a lot of food, but I don't know that I have a favorite food. And am I supposed to? Does everybody have a favorite food?
Yeah, mine's fisher zhile and kumpir. It's a Slovenian dish.
I don't have a favorite food, but there's a lot of food that I love. So I'll skip that one. Do I golf? No. I have played golf, I think, 3 times. I've gone to driving ranges a couple of dozen times, but in last years, there are a number of things in my life that I realize that in this lifetime, I'm not going to have time to get to. Being a major sports fan is one of those things. I don't have that time. Playing golf is another one of those things. I just realized that I'm not going to have the time to play that game very much unless, my life changes. As far as how old I am, that is a matter of public record, and shame on you for asking a woman her age. Oh, but you know what? Since I'm not a woman, I guess you can ask me. Shoot. I was born on June 27th, 1963. Next question.
Okay. Kurt is asking, some people have criticized your book, If You Can Keep It, for taking too rosy a view of some of the founders. Apparently, toward the end of his life, Franklin wrote a letter in which he expressed both doubt as to the divinity of Jesus and a rather limited pragmatic view of Jesus's teachings. How do you respond to that criticism?
Okay, first of all, I have to say, and I say this humbly and lovingly, but anyone who has criticized my books is a jerk.
Yeah.
You know what? I didn't mean that in the true sense of the word jerk. What I meant was people are free to criticize my books, but on Ask Metaxas, I guess I will have to defend them. All right. That is a good question. This kind of gets back to the question in the previous segment about marriage. And I think that it always is about context. I would state emphatically that I don't think I take too rosy a view of the founders or the founding at all. I think what I state emphatically, because it is true, is that every single one of the founders understood that virtue and faith were at the very center, without any question, of the kind of self-government and liberty they were giving us in the Constitution. There is no question about that, and there are no exceptions. Benjamin Franklin and Jefferson, while having what I would certainly consider unorthodox views theologically, doesn't make us force them to go outside the camp and be stoned. Their views on how virtue and faith interacted to give us the ability to be truly free, to have a kind of self-government that the world had never dreamt of really before the 18th century. I really think that, on that, there is no question that it's true. I think it has been understated. And I think that on the contrary, not only do I not have too rosy a view of the founders and of the founding, but I think most historians have had not enough rosy a view. Actually, that's putting it strangely, but have had a sour negative view. I think it's since the 1960s in particular, academics have made a speciality, so to speak, of finding the worms in the apple. They forget about the apple and they look for the dark thing that they can write a dissertation on or make a name for themselves. I think that, frankly, they've done a grand disservice to most of the population in that, and that they need to acknowledge what I write about so forcefully in my book, If You Can Keep It, that the founders, without any question, understood the value of Christianity. Most of them were, in fact, theologically orthodox Christians, but even those who were not, nonetheless, understood utterly and completely the value and centrality of Christian faith and the value of virtue in this thing that we call the American experiment. There's simply no doubt about that. And I think that the only thing that I misstate in my book, If You Can Keep It, is I slightly overstate religious liberty before 1776, because there were places in the 13 colonies where that didn't exist. Nonetheless, largely, I'm correct in stating that there was a tremendous amount of religious liberty already in existence before the founding of the United States. So that's my long answer. If you prefer the short answer, I can give that to you after class.
Okay, thank you. By the way, there's a chipmunk outside my bunker window that keeps distracting me. Simon asks, Eric, can you please expand upon your interest in The Mysterious Island by Jules Verne? Why is it included in your list of recommended books? And the book has a satisfying spirit and industry and camaraderie, and I enjoy the connection to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Whoops, we're getting the wrap-up sign here from James.
We know we've got a whole minute left. Honestly, the Mysterious Island probably shouldn't be there because there are so many books that I think of as much as well of as I do The Mysterious Island. It's a great book just because I love Jules Verne. There's a whole bunch of Jules Verne's books that I want to put in there. That may be the one that I had read most recently when I was making up that list. But I think it's high time I put a new list on my website. Go to ericmetaxas.com. It's incumbent upon you, sir, madam, to go to ericmetaxas.com and check out all the free stuff that's there. You can get a free pack of cigarettes if you go there before midnight tonight. We'll be back for another segment. Tracking down the hours. But where were all your shoulders when we cried? Were the darlings on the sideline dreaming up? Of... Hey there, folks. Welcome back to the Eric Metaxas Show. We're doing Ask Metaxas. This is actually the final segment of Ask Metaxas for this week, because our next segment is a special segment that we like to call English as a First Language. Do not miss it. I promise you, you will like it. But Ask Metaxas, guys, we got plenty more questions. Go.
Okay. Kurt from Tucson asks, do you think it's possible that the wine Jesus miraculously created from water for the wedding in Cana of Galilee made its drinkers undrunk as they drank it? Perhaps a better way of putting it is sober-minded, as so termed several places in the Bible. The master of the feast became quite sober-minded after sampling the wine that was water, didn't he?
I think the answer to that is no. I do not think that that wine made them sober-minded. I think the whole point of the story – I shouldn't say the whole point of the story, but one of the points of the story is, in fact, that it was alcoholic wine. Now, we already know that the kind of wine drunk in antiquity was typically less alcoholically potent than the wine that we drink today. We know that the wine – that they drank, for example, in classical Greece, if it was a Dionysian banquet, it would be a mixture of 3-to-1 with water. If it was an Apollinian banquet, it would have been mixed 5-to-1 with water so that they would be more sober-minded. But whatever the case, I think the point of the story is that when people get drunk, we serve them the cheap wine. And in that parable, in fact, Jesus says, we're going to serve the best wine last. There's a lot to that story, because Jesus, he was the last prophet. He was the best. We don't have prophets as we did in the Old Testament. God always serves the best last. God does everything upside down. The greatest leader is the servant of all. So anyway, the short answer to that question is no, but it was a great question.
Oh, it really was. Thank you, Kurt. Alex asks, where were you during 9/11? Are there any ways in which it personally impacted you, or ways that you saw God work in the city?
Ways that it impacted me. People don't realize, but I had a 40% ownership in the World Trade Center, so I lost a lot of money. Just kidding. No, Suzanne and I and our then 2-year-old daughter were living here in New York City when it happened. It was one of the most horrifying moments of my life when I turned on the TV and realized what was happening. And I guess I was having breakfast with a friend, Emerson Egerich. He was here in the city. I've invited him on this program, and I've talked to him about his book, Love and Marriage. Dear friend, we had breakfast. It was a glorious day.
Yeah.
And I went back to my apartment, and it was early, and I had a voice message saying, hey, do you see what's going on at the World Trade Center? You should check it out. So I turned on the TV and saw planes circling the World Trade Center. Obviously, the two planes had already hit. But I remember watching on the TV live when one of the buildings collapsed. And I'll never forget it, because I spontaneously burst into tears in that second, knowing that thousands had just died and I had just witnessed it. It was harrowing. I feel that I was in a strange depression for weeks after that. It was just something that I can't even describe. And a lot of times when people have memorials, 9/11 memorials and stuff, and they want to talk about it, I don't want to. It's like, I don't even want to remember it, because it was so painful. You could smell, we're 4 miles north, or we were 4 miles north at the time of the actual site. And for a couple of days, you could smell this sickly sweet smoke coming through the windows, some of which was human remains that had been vaporized. I mean, it was a traumatic time. I don't know what more I can say about it right now, but I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
We all have our stories, but we're not going to share them now. Chris.
Yes. Luke Gatos. Yes. In your book, If You Can Keep It, you mentioned that 80% of the American colonists heard George Whitefield preach in person in the 1970s. How is that number calculated? Could you point to where you have found this or the original source for this?
That's a trick question, because George Whitefield was dead in the 1970s.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said seven. I should have said 1700s. Wasn't he a disco guy?
Yeah. He's actually Stu the Disco Guy from The Simpsons, who's based on the evangelist George Whitfield. A lot of people don't know that. Okay. I make the claim in my book, If You Can Keep It, which I recommend, that George Whitfield preached so much up and down the 13 colonies during his many, many visits to the 13 colonies, because, of course, he went back and forth from England to the 13 colonies, actually 13 times back and forth. He died here in Newburyport, Massachusetts in 1770. So Whitfield, he's such a phenomenon as a preacher that it's very hard for us to imagine in a day before there were microphones that he could have preached to as many as he did. But it has been estimated in several accounts. I can't remember specifically from where I got it, but that he preached in person to nearly 80% of everyone alive in the 13 colonies at that time. The reason that's not surprising is that if George Whitfield showed up someplace to preach, people came from hours around to hear him. There was no celebrity at that time except for George Whitfield. And if he was preaching, there's an account, firsthand account in my book, If You Can Keep It, of a farmer riding so far. I mean, it's just stunning. But they heard that he would be preaching, I think, in Middletown, Connecticut, where Wesleyan stands today. And there's just no doubt about it that he was so wildly popular that if it was possible to hear him, almost no one would have missed the opportunity to hear him. But the specific citation, I don't have that off the top of my head. I think we're out of time.
Yeah, we're wrapping it up.
It's fun to do Ask Metaxas because I love hearing from listeners. We've got plenty more questions. You can write us at our websites and just say it's an Ask Metaxas question, but we have fun. We'll do it every week as if we can. Our next segment, folks, get ready. Get ready. It is English as a First Language. Do not miss it.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone.
Hey there, folks. This is the Eric Metaxas Show, and we've got a special segment right now. We haven't done this in a while. It's called English as a First Language. Chris, James, Albin, these are always fun because most of us speak English as a first language, not as a second language, right?
Yavol.
Right.
See. Si.
And so I feel as an English major and as a writer, I want to help people when they get stuff wrong. So this is something that happened on TV about 3 weeks ago. And I thought at some point I need to mention this in an English as a second language official segment. Here's what happened. I flip around and every now and again for laughs, I'll turn to CNN, for example, to see what they're bitter and sour about today. Perhaps we put a man on the moon and we do it quickly enough, or, you know, something like that. What are they complaining about? Well, Van Jones was on. Now, Van Jones, he's the one that famously called Trump's election a white lash, and he can be bitter. But usually I like him as a person. I had the privilege of sitting next to him on a plane ride a few years ago. He is a Christian. He's very left wing. But we had a nice conversation. But the other day or other week, he was on TV and he used a phrase, and this is very important that we all get this right if we're English speakers. Van Jones was referring to something not being up to snuff. Now, we've all heard the phrase up to snuff.
Yes.
Okay. Not meeting a certain standard, right? Another phrase you could use that is similar to that, you say, you know, that didn't cut the mustard, right? Now, I always wondered, where did that phrase come from? Cut the mustard. What does that even mean? And it has to do, I think, with snuff is something that, like, let's say you're feeling drowsy, you take a pinch of snuff and boom, it kind of wakes you up. Mustard was the same way in the 18th century. Mustard was sort of Maybe it was a difficult spice to get. And so, if something really had tang, really had boom, it had the mustard. So they would say that, that didn't cut the mustard. It wasn't up to snuff. So the problem, though, is that Van Jones on a panel on CNN 3 weeks ago said that something, he says, I don't really believe that cut the cheese.
No.
And I looked at the panel and I realized I think some people on the panel didn't pick up what he just said, this mistake. And I think the other people on the panel are using everything they can summon as professionals not to horse laugh, because that's extremely funny. Now, if anybody's not getting the joke, I don't know. But some people will already know this, as you guys do, but the phrase cut the cheese, if there's a big cheese encased in wax, right, in the old days, and they would cut it, suddenly the pungent, strong aroma of cheese would fill the room. So when someone passes gas and it's noticeable, and I don't mean noticeably audibly, but in an olfactory sense, someone will sniff the air and say, who cut the cheese? Right. So when Van Jones meant to say that wasn't up to snuff, that didn't cut the mustard, and he said that didn't cut the cheese, not only was it extremely funny, but it was incorrect. And since I don't know how to reach Van, I really do think he's a nice guy. I'm not making that up. I had a very nice conversation with him. But when he said that, I thought that's the classic kind of thing, that here you have an incredibly intelligent guy. English is his first language, but he misspoke. Maybe he realized it later. But I just want my audience, to say you folks out there, to know that something being up to snuff, to cut the mustard, to be up to a certain standard, that's one thing. To say cut the cheese is something entirely different. Lucky for you all, we're out of time. Thanks for listening. God bless you.